I was saying to Jennifer before I, when I first got here, that I spent the day on the telephone and emailing, and I really wonder a lot of times how a nice girl like me ended up not doing my art full time, but taking on larger issues. You know, I started out, and the early projects that I was doing, the kind of physical and visceral engagement that the viewer could have with the work was really interesting to me. But equally interesting was how you could step outside of the framework of the art world. And this was the 70s. There were many people crossing boundaries, figuring out new ways of doing things. Of course, each generation is always criticizing what came before. And as I looked at Smithson's work or some of the other work that was done, I felt that it was still so much within the art context. I really felt that, you know, if something was out in the desert, you had to hire an airplane to fly over it or get a special, go on a trip like that. It wasn't what I was interested in. I really wanted to find ways to engage people in an intimate and direct way with a site. So being increasingly over the years, being more and more in the public domain and more in the city, I kind of drifted from areas where it was kind of easier to work into the city over the years. And in doing that, I started to participate in some of these larger planning processes, working with the architect Robert Mangurian to develop a plan for a new district in the old theater area of St. Louis, trying to bring that back as a vital area of the city. Looking at a waterfront in Milwaukee, but taking on larger issues of the city. A few years ago, I was working on a design team to develop a 1,300-acre park in Orange County, California. And in doing that, I was really trying to imagine, I had just finished a park, again, a collaborative project, in Santa Fe, and one of the things we realized is that a lot gets eliminated between the design and the construction of the park because of regulations or all kinds of reasons. And so many of the things that we were including in the park to make issues of the environment apparent to visitors got cut out. So starting that large park project, I thought, okay, let's find a way to make sure that it's not just something that's seen as the icing that can be removed. And we came up with the idea of developing a research and residency center so that issues of sustainability, whether social, economic, environmental, ecological, historical, all, you know, the broad range of sustainability could be looked at in collaborations between artists and experts, other experts, throughout the life of the project. There could be temporary projects or permanent works, but that the park would always be a place where people could come and have a direct and visceral experience of the thing that was going to be looked at, rather than just being told you shouldn't do this or you should do that, finding really compelling ways to engage people in the issues. The key points of that idea had to do with the visceral experience that the arts can allow people, that can engage people, the emotional, physical, conceptual, all of those tied together. The other thing was that it wasn't going to be an artist going off on their own and doing a riff on some aspect of sustainability, but it was work that was really intended to come out of a collaborative process with whoever they chose to work with. The other part of this is that I've been doing only public work for the last several decades, and my route to doing that has been a percent for art project, which was one half or 1%, coming in usually quite late. So I was really interested in coming up with a different way of working, where artists could look at the issues that they felt were most compelling. This kind of came out of my work on a proposal around the perimeter of Ground Zero that I did with Victoria Marshall and Elliot Maltby, where we were trying to find a way of dealing with all of these people flocking down to my neighborhood, to Ground Zero, and having no way to mourn or to express their feelings about what had happened, but they were kind of put in the position of being gawkers, you know, just looking at this situation. So after that experience of working on that, I thought, I want to work on the issues that I'm really compelled by, not the leftover traffic island that this commission asks you to look at, or, you know, that assignment orientation of percent was getting more and more frustrating. So I just wanted to give you this background for how, you know, I'm not an architect, I'm not a planner, I'm not a landscape architect, I'm not an engineer. I hope I can stay an artist and touch all of those areas. I'd like to keep my role. So the park project in California didn't happen, and there were such compelling ideas about that. When I was doing the project in Boulder, I met a woman who had organized the larger conference, Marta Kern, whose background was in performance and dance, and she'd been organizing a series of art and ecology festivals in Boulder over a few years. She and I started a conversation, and at a certain point she came to New York and we began to work on this idea of taking the park as a living laboratory and changing it into the city as a living laboratory. How could you come up with a way of thinking about providing a framework for cities to begin to link culture and sustainability? So I want to show you, instead of speaking abstractly about this, I kind of like this background music. It gets really, it's good, getting ready. But this is the project that was done in Boulder. And I just want you to get this sense of what I'm talking about with the physical and visceral, which, since you are all in the arts, you probably get the idea. But in this case, I was working with a geomorphologist and a hydrologist from the US Geological Survey in Boulder. And Boulder is considered one of the highest hazard zones in the western United States. It's at the mouth of a canyon, and there has to be only one rainstorm at the top of the canyon in the summer, and there will be a catastrophic flood in Boulder, a 500-year flood. That's what Katrina was considered, a 500-year event. So the scientists were had all of this information in their papers and computers. The city fathers and mothers were telling citizens they should worry about this, but it's really hard to take things seriously. I mean, we all have so many problems we deal with every day. Okay, that's another one. I don't have to worry. It's not happening right now. So I put 300 six-inch diameter blue disc markers up on trees and the infrastructure of downtown Boulder. So as you walk through the city, the center of the city, you were able to have the area that we then plotted out on a map to see where that flooding would happen. You had that made visible to you. You could see that sometimes if you were up at the doorway there at the entrance to the library, the water was only going to be 2 feet high. But if you were coming out of the high school, it was this high, and if you were on the bike path, it might be 18 feet in the air. And so it was, the project was called Connect the Dots, Mapping the High Water of Boulder Creek. But this visceral kind of way of communicating this event, so that it was no longer just an abstract idea, but something that you could measure directly to yourself. We also, with the help of another scientist, Mark Boulders, that had been moved in a pre-settlement flood. These boulders were sometimes, 15 feet across. So it wasn't just that it was saying, it's not just that you're in a swimming pool, kind of treading water. This water comes down the canyon with a terrific force that could move cars, trees, bridges. And this is one of the boulders. So to go back to this idea of the city as living lab, we really wanted to, again, take the ideas of the multiple aspects of sustainability, they seem to be so interconnected. It's hard to say, oh, we're only going to look at climate change or at one particular aspect, because they're all so linked. As we've talked about it, we've broadened this to be the arts. When I started out, I was really thinking about artists, landscape architects, but as Marta entered the project, it became, you know, it could be poets, dancers. It's a much broader kind of definition of the arts. But the key point was that the collaboration would be happening. And we said, if you were going into a city, you could divide up the issues looking at natural systems or infrastructure or social programs, and you could do those on a variety of scales. Now remember, this is kind of like we're trying to make a roadmap to go into the Office of Sustainability in the city and say, here's how you could proceed in your city to make these issues visible to the citizens. So they could be done at the small scale of the block or on a much larger scale of the city. But and then to give examples, the Boulder project was given as a natural systems problem. This is a 30-acre sewage treatment plant that we were upgrading and turning into a public space in Arlington, Virginia. We said this is one way you could look at infrastructure, trying to turn your infrastructure into an amenity and engage the public in the issues of what happens in a water treatment plant and how their lives relate to that plant. Or you could look at social issues, and I'll talk a bit about this project in a bit, but this is the project in India, taking a derelict site in a very poor neighborhood in Delhi. But as we talked about this, we said, okay, why would you want to bother to do this? But it seemed that one of the things that happens in cities is that in New York, there's really quite a wonderful plan called Plan YC, and the Department of Transportation talks to city planning, talks to the Mayor's Office of Long-Term Sustainability, but how do people on the ground get to know about this? How do the citizens who could begin to really make this change happen, how do they become aware of these initiatives and what's trying to be done? So we're saying, you know, let these ground level projects inform people at street level about the programs and policies that cities have in mind. The other thing is that we're trying to say, let's not reinvent the wheel. Why don't we use existing institutions, partnerships with existing resources to build upon, rather than coming up with a whole new idea of a different kind of percent for art program or having to start up a whole new institution. The other thing is, as we're trying to convince this Miss or Mr. Sustainability in the office that we've managed to get into, is that these issues that may take years, say 30 years, to reduce air pollution by a certain percentage, in the first 5 years, you could do a number of events or projects or installations that would get people's attention to the issues, so that actually air pollution could be addressed in a much more compelling way by people really starting to do things that could make a difference. Then we talked about where this could happen, whether it's the using existing spaces in the city, infrastructure, institutional spaces, all kinds of public spaces, or the virtual spaces that are providing so many really interesting ways to communicate and network, and which the great people who work with me in the studio inform me about, things I have no clue about until they tell me about. But to go back, I think I skipped one, to talk about a specific project again and how issues of social sustainability might be addressed. The city of Delhi is going to have the Commonwealth Games there in 2012, and in the past 4 years they've been trying to transform Delhi into a modern city, and one of the things they've done is close down many factories and really tried to clean the air of the city. But as they do that, they kind of forget what the effect is of some of these large broad brush moves that they're making. This particular community that we're looking at, adjacent to a park, had a 300-year-old vegetable market. It had a big shoe factory, a textile mill in this community, which supported a very workable working class community. After everything was shut down within about a 3-week period, the whole community had the bottom fall out from it. And so I really wanted to try and address sustainability at the level of the individual and how life could be supported in a healthy way within this context. So there was this beautiful Mughal pavilion, 17th century pavilion, that you can see in the background there, which was a derelict site. This whole area that you see covered with a pattern was filled with garbage. And I thought, how could we take this existing structure that's in this community and turn it into an amenity? Not only make it an amenity where people could come for some relief, but look at the idea of a garden and a medicinal garden. We soon found out that no plants could be planted here because it's an archaeological site. It's okay if there's trash, but you know, we can't put any plants there. So we came up with the idea of laying this pattern down, almost like a textile, over this whole area, naming the about 100 different Ayurvedic plants, which are the basis of the Indian medicinal system that's most commonly used. So we named the plants and gave the use in English and in Hindi. And then around the base of the pavilion, we laid out about 2,000 of the actual plants, naming them so that people could see how they're used. And then we had a series of speakers come during the time the installation was up to tell people about the plants and how they could grow them. Some of them can be used with to make teas or used in a direct way without being processed, grown on rooftops or on kitchen windowsills. So there was also this little portable park that announced when the speakers would be at the park, and we put about 5 of them out in the adjacent community, and different store owners put them out each day to let people know what was going on. So I just wanted to give you examples of what we're talking about here. And my collaborators in this case were a landscape architect, but also this medicinal plant grower who advised us on what we could be using and which would be the most effective plants to show people. One more picture there. So there are a couple of things that we've undertaken. One I'm not going to be showing you, which is a project in Indianapolis focusing on the White River and trying to get the city to understand the relationship, the citizens of the city, to understand the relationship of this river to their lives and how this river supports their lives. The river's kind of hidden. It's not, it was never navigable, so it's not a working waterfront like many cities have for their rivers. And as we, you know, thought about what we could do there, the idea was really to make a series of stopping places along the river where different aspects could be revealed. But we're ending up putting these almost like map pins, like an oversized 6-inch red ball, like an oversized map pin, at different sites, and then through text or audio messaging let people know what that site is about. But the idea was that at this edge of the river, ideas would be start to infiltrate into the community, and a neighborhood might start to mark the water infrastructure of their neighborhood. Where are the detention basins? Getting people to be more aware of the difference between a hard and a porous surface. But this is where the collaboration has gotten interesting and where technology is coming in. And we're really looking at a variety of ways of getting people to go on treasure hunts to find these sites of green infrastructure. We're calling it aqua caching instead of geocaching. We're trying to do a raindrop app so that somebody can follow a raindrop from their home to the river so that they begin to understand that all property is riverfront property, as one of our collaborators says. we're doing another thing where we're putting webcams on existing USGS rain gauges along the river from the headwaters of the river down to the Gulf of Mexico. We hope to have 20 of these so that we can show people that what happens in this river, which provides 70% of their drinking water, is really important. So that's just to give you a sense of how the collaboration is going in that case. But I came to New York, came back to New York last summer, and I was talking to somebody in city planning, and we ended up doing a presentation there about the City as Living Lab. But Amanda Burden, who I'd worked with many years ago on the South Cove, a project I've done along Hudson River, said to me, well, that's fine, you're doing it in Indianapolis, but what about New York City? You know, wouldn't more people know about this? And so I thought about it, and always being one with a rich fantasy life, I said, why don't we imagine turning Broadway into a green corridor for New York City, from the tip of Manhattan up through all the diverse neighborhoods to the top of the city, to take this ancient pathway, this original, you know, path of the island, and make it this scene where all of you know, these new ideas that the city is coming up with in their Plan YC program, that those issues could be made visible and visceral on the street, that they could be identified, that all New Yorkers seem to cross Broadway at one point or another, since almost all subway lines lead from there to the rest of the city. Visitors all come to Broadway, this iconic street. So now we're just taking on this kind of daunting project of imagining how you could begin the process of transforming Broadway. And I just want to stop and say here, one of the reasons we're doing the Indianapolis project or this Broadway project is that we went around and we actually got in to talk to some of the people in the Department of Planning and Sustainability and a few different cities, and they'd say, oh, fine, I see your framework here, but what does it mean? So we're trying to do these as precedent projects to show cities how you could take this approach and maybe on a much smaller scale, maybe only a few blocks of downtown Hartford, or maybe on this river in Des Moines, but to give people an idea of how to proceed with making this connection between the arts and sustainability. The other really important issue is that there is no money. You know, people will, if they're talking about water, they'll say there is no new water. All water is, you know, here that's ever going to be here. There is no new money for the arts. We have to accept that. In fact, there's less and less and less. But one of the things that we're really investigating in a very aggressive way, especially through my partner, Marta Kern, is how art and science funding can be combined. One of the things, I started talking about this Broadway project with a program officer at the National Science Foundation. And I said, you know, we just are desperate for $50,000 for a planning grant to really study and map the length of Broadway. He emails me back the next day and said, what could you do with between $200,000 and $300,000? Because they don't like to give little grants. Now, my mind was, you know, spinning. Now, the trick is I have to find the science partner who's willing to partner with me, and this has taken about 6 months to do this, and we hope to proceed. And then there's no guarantee that what the grants officer thinks will actually be supported. But there are opportunities, and I think people in the National Science Foundation are beginning to see that there is this possibility of not just teaching an artist about science, but that the artists can really maybe take them to places they didn't think of going before. You know, I really, you know, I get kind of upset when people just see us as, oh, these poor people who, you know, don't know science, and we're going to have to, you know, take on this task of informing them. I really think we have a huge amount to offer to the scientists in especially helping them communicate their information, but also maybe getting them to think about things in a different way. I am totally the non-nerd, you know. What I'm really interested in is having is understanding this, some of these very complex systems, like the hydrological cycle, which is simple but very complex. How can you take something like that and take it apart, tease it apart, so that citizens can access this and understand it? How could you take something that's incremental, like climate change or weather pattern change, and reveal that to people? So I just think that the people in the arts have an amazing opportunity that is coming up. And, you know, I also dislike very much the kind of old art world position of, oh, well, you know, who did it first? I mean, so-and-so was doing that 20 years ago. Who do you think you... Look, I think it's like a level playing field here. The more people we can get interested in addressing these issues, I don't care if they're painters. It's like Nancy Spiro going in and doing a public art project in the subway station at Lincoln Center. She had never done any public art projects, and she did this fabulous work. And I'm just using that as an example of people going into territories they may never have gone into before. So just briefly to tell you a little bit about this Broadway project. We're currently calling it, until we come up with a better title, 1,000 Steps, thinking that it takes that many steps to ruin something, and it probably takes more to make it better again. And again, it's the same combination of looking at these combined issues of sustainability. I said to this friend of mine who's a historian, I'm just fascinated that this trail was used so early on and then went all the way to Albany. And my historian friend said, well, that turned into the Post Road and it went all the way to Boston. Mm-hmm. So, hey, we can start here, take on Manhattan, mm-hmm. just work our way up the Eastern Corridor. But we are using, as one of our primary focal points, the Plan YC document, and looking, trying to imagine how we can expose these issues to people so that they aren't, so that they're no longer just abstract. How can you really make air quality apparent to people? How can you, you know, we have to find ways to do this. I don't know what the answers are to any of these things yet, by the way. But we're in the process of coming up with these core partners that we can work with. The Department of City Planning, the Department of Cultural Affairs, the Department of Transportation. We're partnering with the with CUNY at Hunter's Institute for Sustainable Cities. We hope that our science partner in this is going to be the Center for Research in Environmental Decision Making. I'm getting used to all these acronyms. You know, that's called CRED. It's a really interesting group that's looking at how people are making decisions in cities. And then we hope to get future partners as we proceed with this. Parsons would be a great partner, NYU, the Natural History Museum, Columbia, City University, especially those places where there's the possibility of interest, assistance that can be had in understanding what the issues are of that particular node or area. In the studio, we've begun this process of trying to locate where are the green markets, where are the people inside buildings who are dealing with issues of sustainability, where are the brownfields, where are the, you know, as many things as we can find, and we will use these to kind of map our nodes. Ideally, what would I like? I would like to see something out on the street in Broadway from the tip all the way to the end of the city where maybe every two or three blocks you came across an area that was beginning to make these issues apparent to you, not through a spectacle, but through content-oriented minuscule insertions. I turned on Channel 13, which is, I only get three stations, and that's probably the only one I ever see. And there was this documentary. I was so happy. It was on this guy named Jim, and I came in on the end, and I didn't get to see it. But he's the guy, he, I think, had been, what I could get from my coming in at the end is that he had been homeless for a period of time, but he's the person who had put all those little fragments along the base of light lampposts and in cracks on the Lower East Side. I've always loved that project as just a way that you don't try and take the city over, you're just kind of inserting yourself into it. So I'm kind of using Jim as my model of how you could make insertions that are really compelling without trying to, you know, drape the city or something like that. So we're going to be looking at these different, partners, these hub partners, the institutions that I'm talking about. And, you know, this is our beginning to imagine. You know, every two or three blocks probably won't happen easily, but that's when your fantasy life gets really rich. But if we could do 20 nodes along Broadway, that would be great. But so another thing that I'm trying to do as a practitioner is to come up with a toolkit. And this is really different for me because my whole life has been about doing projects based on a particular site, and no two projects were ever the same. And I've wondered, how could I come up with a toolkit where maybe the dots, where, the blue dots are appropriate for a situation for, you know, the river, a water threat being there. Maybe another thing is, I don't know. But I'm imagining that over the next few years I could come up with a set of elements that might be used in multiple situations. So this is actually to show, as I'm going around and talking to city people, when I talk about a modest insertion, I'm showing an element that was actually developed for the Indianapolis project, but I'm applying it to the city here. And that is that you could take a mirror, and one of the things I really like about mirrors is that you can see yourself in it as well as the thing you're trying to get people to look at. So the idea is that you have a mirror, that you put a mark on the thing you want people to notice, or if it was that building, for instance, that's got the green mark on it here, you could outline that build, etch that building into a polished stainless steel, so one way or the other. And then with the mark on the surface of the mirror, you can align those, the mirror is in a permanent position, and an alignment can occur that allows you to name what it is you're looking at. And what really fascinates me about this is that all of the content that may be on a website is out there in the real world, so that it's not just that you have to sit there in front of your computer for hours, but that you could begin to have the city laid out for you and revealed in a very detailed way as you walk down the street. Now, our idea with this is that there would be a number that you could dial up or text into to get a response. There's somebody here who could tell how this works, who's sitting right here. But what I really love is that in the texting, right, you get to enter your three digits, and they said, what three digits do you want? And Liz said, how about NYC? It's like claiming your digits. And they said, sure. So how are we getting the NYC digits, Liz? I don't know, but I thought this was pretty cool. Anyway, that you would be able to, that thanks to my one of the people I'm working with here. So anyway, the idea is that you would be able to not only, well, some people maybe wouldn't do the dial-up or the texting, but they'd get to see the issue named. They'd get to see that there's a green roof on that building that you might not know, or that the building's boiler's been converted. Boiler conversion is one of the biggest issues in the city. We can, you know, focus people on what's happening with the flooding and the subways. I can't do it. Close it up, make it go away. I think that there are so many really wonderful and interesting opportunities. I'm so happy to learn more about Island and what you all are doing here. I think the more ways that we can find to, as practitioners, be able to involve ourselves and help communicate these issues, the more people, the better. So I'm really glad to be here and looking forward to hearing more.